Stand by for the fastest 60 minutes in Jewish radio. It's time for the Jewish Experience. Hi, everyone, and welcome back. We're here for our Hanukkah special, courtesy of our sponsor, WEDO Radio. If you like the program and would like us to continue, we need funding. If you have the cash or ideas, jewishexperience@verizon.net is the place to tell us. Hi, I'm Hirsch DeLynn, your host, and you are tuned in to Pittsburgh's only Jewish radio program, The Jewish Experience. And you're listening to Moshe Bikar live on the keyboard, just specially for you on this Friday afternoon. And this is our Hanukkah special. I'll have a special segment on the significance of Hanukkah coming up. But first, as always, the Parsha this week is Vayeshev. Yaakov makes a multicolored coat for Yosef, and his brothers are jealous. Yosef tells him about his two dreams, which makes the brothers even madder. Shimon and Levi plan to kill him, but Reuven suggests putting him in a pit, since he intends to come back and save him later. Judah ends up selling him to a band of Ishmaelites. The brothers dip Yosef's coat in goat's blood and tells their father that his beloved son was eaten by animals. Judah goes off and marries in another land, and Yosef is sold to Potiphar in Egypt. Potiphar's wife desires Yosef, but he spurns her. And you know what that means. Into the dungeon he goes and ends up interpreting the dreams of the baker and the butler. Yosef asks the butler to help him get out of jail since he gave him a favorable report, but the butler loses the get-out-of-jail card, he forgets, and you have to read next week's Parsha to find out what happens next. And speaking of favorable reports, the staff of the JE brings you favorable tidings this Hanukkah with Rabbi Meir Goldwasser, Moshe Bikar, Ms. Deborah DeLynn, and Dr. Michael Shulman. So sit back and enjoy 60 minutes of the best Jewish radio in southwestern Pennsylvania. Our guests today are Rabbi Chaim Reichman, director of the Temple Institute. His fascinating work restoring the vessels for the Holy Temple is not without controversy, and his institute promotes all aspects of awareness of the temple in eager anticipation of its rebuilding with the coming of Mashiach. And we also welcome Yisroel Medad, director of the Menachem Begin Center and an Israeli political expert. We'll talk with him about the prospects for Israel under an Obama administration and what the future holds for Jewish leadership in Israel. Of course, we'll have your community announcements and mazel tovs along with current news, fresh from Israel National Radio, coming up on the half hour. Don't forget, you can always find us on the web at jewishexperienceradio.com. Even when we are on our hiatus, you can go to the show that corresponds to the Jewish calendar week and listen to that show. Of course, the Israel news and community news will not be up to date, but you can still be entertained and learn a lot. Don't forget, candlelighting time tonight, 4:38 p.m. We'll be right back. Now with an insight on this week's Parsha is our resident rabbi, Rabbi Meir Goldwasser.
Although Chanukah is celebrated for only 8 days in the year, its message and the message of the Chanukah lights are valid and compelling all year round. Two other important lights are the lights of the seven-branched menorah that was lit daily in the Beis HaMikdash, and the Shabbos lights kindled in the Jewish home every Friday evening. There are three noteworthy points of distinction between the Chanukah lights and the other two lights. A. The Shabbos candles must be lit before sunset, and the lights in the Beis HaMikdash were lit even earlier. The Chanukah lights, however, must be kindled after sunset, when it is already dark. B. The menorah of the Beis HaMikdash was inside. The place of the Shabbos lights is likewise indoors on the Shabbos table. The Chanukah lights, however, are to be kindled in such a place that their light should be seen outside. C. Finally, the lights of the Beis HaMikdash and of the Shabbos remain the same in number and are not increased, while the number of Chanukah lights are increased every night. The message of Chanukah is important and timely to all of us at all times. The lesson, which seems to be indicated by the Chanukah lights, is that we must not only light up the home, as do the Shabbos candles, and the synagogue, substituting for the sanctuary of old, but we have the additional responsibility of lighting up the outside, our social and business environments. Moreover, when conditions are unfavorable, it is dark outside, it is then not enough to kindle a light and maintain it, although this is also an achievement, for even a little light of Torah and mitzvahs can dispel a great deal of darkness. But it is necessary to increase the lights steadily, through steadily growing efforts to spread the light of Torah and mitzvahs. These ever-growing efforts contain in themselves the assurance of ever-growing success.
Very excited today to have with us Yisroel Medad, who is the unofficial spokesman for the Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria and works at the Menachem Begin Heritage Center in Jerusalem. He has worked as a political aide to members of Knesset, lectured at the Academy for National Studies, directed Israel's Media Watch, and as a guest media columnist on media affairs for the Jerusalem Post. He's also had a weekly media show on Arush Sheva Radio. Yisroel, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, we're glad to have you. And we have some questions for you that people in Pittsburgh have been asking, and you have been the go-to guy that have been recommended by some of our listeners here in Pittsburgh. Our first question is, President-elect Obama has a long past as a Palestinian supporter, and during his race for the presidency, he seemed to become an Israeli supporter. Have you seen, in with all your political experience, a real true shift here or political expediency? And what will be the results for American-Israeli relations?
I think I'd have to go more with political expediency from what I have read and heard. Most of his close aides and advisors on Middle East affairs seem to be more towards the left wing in American politics. I'm talking about the so-called Mali trip to the United States, to Cairo and Damascus, perhaps. Whether or not he spoke with Hamas, some of his other male and female advisors, including, of course, Brzezinski, who we don't have a very good memory of from the Begin days, in fact. And it would seem to me that he's coming straight out of I guess what we would call liberal progressive ideology in American politics, which over the past 25 years or so has been very, very critical of Israel and, to my regret, very misunderstanding of what Israel's needs are in this area.
Okay, so if he comes and proposes a two-state solution and is very strong in that area, very similar, I guess, to what Bush has done, what will be the Israeli response?
Well, it depends, of course, who the prime minister is.
Well, assuming it's probably going to be Netanyahu, I would assume, based on the polling.
Okay, if we assume it's going to be Netanyahu, Mr. Netanyahu is going to say that the track record of the Arabs in establishing something called a Palestinian state has been very poor in terms of Israel's security. He had this idea of reciprocity. When he was last time prime minister between 96 and 99. In other words, Israel doesn't do anything unless the Arabs prove that they have done something. Now, when you establish a two-state solution, of course, that's not even correct because that would have to be a three-state solution immediately because Hamas is entrenched in the Gaza Strip.
Yes, yes.
Now, if Mr. Obama can get rid of Hamas in Gaza, then maybe he really is the Messiah.
So,
I don't see how the two-state solution come down with Hamas and Gaza the way it is.
Well, what would you like to see from Obama to show that his shift is more true? What would you want
to
see?
Very simple. There's a very simple test here. Do you allow Jews to be killed? If you don't want Jews to be killed, then the first thing you do before moving anything along on the political, diplomatic, economic front is to make sure the Palestinians don't have the ability or the will to kill. And the ability is to take away their arms. And the other thing is to make sure that their educational and media systems do not propagate the type of hatred and hostility towards Jews that they have. It also means cutting off their links to Iran. And, of course, this is a major problem for the world because what we're facing in Gaza and probably maybe at least at this point a third to a half in Judea and Samaria is this type of Islamic jihad ideology which views Jews as persons not to be dealt with diplomatically, but to be killed on the field of battle one way or another.
Okay, so that's going to be kind of tough for the U.S. to dictate to the West Bank Arabs unless they may or may not care.
Well, they seem to be able to dictate to Israel very well.
I know, and unfortunately Israel does care, and that's could be a problem. There are some in Israel that would wish that America would go away and take its money, and they would be very happy about that. So I don't know how practical that is, but there's been a big movement now to tell America to keep its money and let Israel, so to speak, grow up. You have any comment on that?
Well, it's called, I think it was called Tough Love by one of the columnists. Of course, on that thing, you have the former editor of Haaretz, David Landau, asking Condoleezza Rice and other people to help rape Israel. So we've got very type of weird type of people in Israel. We're very prolific type of people when it comes to ideas and attitudes. However, I think the majority of the population is not very interested in that way. And I hope that the incoming American administration will quickly realize that to pressure Israel is not to gain peace, but to set things all in the wrong direction all at once.
Okay. Well, let's move on to something more immediate to Israel and its internal situation. The Likud chairman, Bibi Netanyahu, has been seemingly running a campaign against the Jewish leadership movement or Manikat Yehudit leader Moshe Feiglin, rather than working to create a principle-based campaign to win in the February elections. So will this strategy of Netanyahu's work to get the Likud more seats in the Knesset, and will Feiglin really gain strength to come back to unseat him in the next Likud elections for chairman?
Well, I think he's stuck between a major problem. It has been proven in most polls and most elections over the past 10 years or so that there is a large body politics supposedly called the center, which is basically a floating vote. And it does really move in the last 2 to 3 weeks of a campaign, maybe upwards of 20% one way or another. And in Mr. Netanyahu's opinion, that center is very much affected by left-wing media. And in this case, I think he's made a slight mistake in highlighting or profiling so visibly his antagonism to Mr. Moshe Feiglin, which is understandable because he does not want Likud to be the old ideological party it once was under Menachem Begin, but what it proclaims to be today, a national liberal party, which is, in other words, just right of center. However, I would think, and I, up until now, I don't think I'm wrong, is that most people at the present moment are very much further to the right,
right,
because of the way the situation has gone. So I think he's made a gamble in presuming that that center is larger than it is, and that people want a Likud-led government, and they don't really care about Moshe Feiglin, who's one or two and a half people within a Knesset list of maybe upwards of 30 to 35. So I think he could have played it by simply saying, I don't agree with Mr. Feiglin's ideology. This is not my Likud. I don't think it's the majority Likud. However, there's democracy in the party, and that's what happened. Let's get on with the campaign.
I think you're right, and I think it makes a lot more sense because now what he's doing, I think, is making Moshe Feiglin out to be the martyr, and I think that's attracting a lot of attention to his situation. But in the short time we have left, Feiglin has actually brought out a historical reference to show that as the Likud gets more to the right over time in every election that it does that, it gains more seats. When it shoots for the center, it loses seats because people feel, why should they bother? They'll go to other parties that are more to the right or just go to Kadima where they or some other party which doesn't really stand for much of anything. So any comment on that? You've got about a minute left.
Well, I'm not quite sure that theory goes very well in all elections or in this election to this present moment. Tzipi Livni of the past few days has proven to be a very good campaigner. And so we must take that in consideration, fighting over what I think I defined as the political center. And with all the right-wing parties giving a lot of problems, he still needs to hold on to the center because what will happen is that the right-wing parties, we're really in a mess at the present moment, in my opinion, are not going to be attractive. So they've got to go somewhere. You don't want them to go to Kadima. And therefore, I think at the present moment, it seems Bibi's running a fair campaign. But we don't know. I mean, with more Qassams coming in from Gaza,
right.
That's what's going to hold Bibi and Feiglin together in the vote.
Great. Well, that's it. Our time is up, and I appreciate you being with us. And it's good insight on a Friday, Erev Shabbos, on the Jewish Experience radio program. Yisrael Maidad, the unofficial spokesman for the Jewish communities of Judea and Samaria and the Menachem Begin Heritage Center, thank you again for being with us. Have a good Shabbos.
Thank you, and Shabbat Shalom to you and all our listeners.
Thank you. The Jewish history moment, the significance of Hanukkah. A holiday occurs each year during this time called Hanukkah, observed by Jews all over the world. Many Christians and even some Jews mistakenly believe Hanukkah is the Jewish Christmas, since gifts are exchanged and lights are lit. Actually, except for the two holidays occurring about the same time, they have no relationship. Hanukkah represents a religious miracle that's culminated in a military victory and a rededication to Jewish religious practices. It's a reminder of how a small band of countrymen, the Maccabees, can protect their freedom against insurmountable odds. It also reminds us that we have a responsibility to act first before we can expect any help from above. The Greek king Antiochus Epiphanes became king in 175 BCE. At the same time, in Jerusalem, there was a small movement to become assimilated with the pagan cultures surrounding Israel. Jews who joined this movement were called Hellenists. Antiochus quickly agreed to support and encourage this new movement. With his authority growing throughout the Middle East, Antiochus decided to conquer Egypt and its king Ptolemy. Fresh from his victory in Egypt, he next turned his attention to Israel and the temple in Jerusalem with its rich storehouse of treasures donated by the people over many years. He desecrated the holy places and plundered the temple. 2 years later, Antiochus returned to Jerusalem allegedly as a friend. The Book of the Maccabees relates, he came to Jerusalem with an impressive force, addressing them with what appeared to be peaceful words. He gained their confidence. Then suddenly he fell the city, dealing it a terrible blow and destroying many of the people of Israel. He pillaged the city and set it on fire, tore down its houses and encircling wall, took the women and children captive and commandeered the cattle. They installed an army of sinful people, renegades, who fortified themselves inside it, storing arms and provisions and depositing there the loot that they had collected from Jerusalem. Antiochus continued the growth of his government, issuing proclamations that everyone was to abandon his own ways and conform to the king's decrees. There were book burnings and desecrations of holy places. Whenever someone was caught observing his own faith, he was put to death. And the Book of the Maccabees describes the barbarism that took place. Women who had their children circumcised were put to death according to the edict, with their babies hung around their necks. And the members of their household and those who had performed the circumcision were executed with them. The evil of Antiochus' tyranny did not go unopposed, however. Mattathias, the high priest in the town of Modiin, led a resistance that stood against overwhelming odds. The king's commissioners came to Mattathias and asked him, as the community leader, to be the first to step forward and conform to the king's decrees. Mattathias was offered gold and silver and many presents. His answer to the king was to kill the commissioners and flee to the hills with any who would remain faithful to God and his law. Mattathias became very strong and popular. He attracted a group called the Hasmoneans to assist him. He traveled with his group trying to persuade his countrymen to resist the evil and overthrow the king's rule. After Mattathias' death, his son Judah took command of the freedom fighters. He was a skillful leader, and with the help of heaven, his small band of followers slowly began to win. Not just physical battles, but also battles for the spirit of the Jewish people. Now that the people had hope, there was no stopping them. After Judah's freedom fighters routed the enemy, their first task was to rededicate the sanctuary in Jerusalem. It was in total ruins. The altar desecrated, the gates burned down, and vegetation growing in the courts, as it might in a wood or some mountain, while the storerooms were in ruins. After they thoroughly removed the pagan influences from the sanctuary, they rededicated the temple. One of the first tasks was to light the temple menorah. There was only one flask of consecrated oil that was permitted to be burned in the menorah. Each flask contained enough oil to last for one day. Miraculously, the oil lasted for 8 days, allowing them to obtain more consecrated oil without any interruption in the light of the menorah. The holiday of Hanukkah is celebrated by Jews who each light their own menorah as a symbol of the temple menorah. One candle is added each night to increase the light until the 8th night, when all 8 candles burn. The menorah is always placed at the entrance to the home or near a window where all can see. It is a symbol of freedom from religious persecution for all nations and should be enjoyed by all. Traditionally, Hanukkah is celebrated by giving children gelt or coins, one each night to teach of the miracle that occurred. And the dreidel, a top, is spun to remind us of how Jews would teach the children the letters of the Hebrew alphabet. During the time of the Greek rule, the Jews were forbidden to study the Bible, so they continued teaching their children through games. To this approach, if a Greek soldier came by, he would detect only the game and not the forbidden teachings. Ecclesiastes said, "There's nothing new under the sun." Let us learn the lessons of the Maccabees and understand that to overcome evil in our time only requires desire and action of a small group of dedicated patriots, patriots who understand that they must take that first step before relying on the help of heaven.
Here's the news from Israel National Radio for Friday, December the 19th, the 22nd of Kislev 5769. I am Walter Bingham. The fragile ceasefire between Israel and the terror group Hamas has officially ended this morning. It was agreed on June the 19th to last for 6 months, but has been crumbling from the first day. Since she withdrew from the Gaza Strip in 2005, around 10,000 rockets have been fired at Israel from there by terrorist groups. Even during the ceasefire, there was hardly a lull. Since last Wednesday, Israel counted 43 missiles against her territory. It has been reported that in Gaza, Hamas leaders went underground for fear of being targeted by Israel. They have also evacuated many institutions and security installations in anticipation of attacks by the IDF. With just over 7 weeks to go before Israelis elect a new government, the main political parties have now selected their choice of candidates on their respective party lists, and the campaign heads into its final stage. Pollsters commissioned by the various national newspapers and TV networks estimate that Likud will get 33 seats, Kadima 23, Labour 13, Shas and the Israel is Our Home Party and the combined Arab parties 10 seats each. A number of minor parties are still negotiating mergers. Likud leader Bibi Netanyahu mentioned in the past that he is in favor of a national unity government, and combined with Kadima, these figures would give him the Knesset majority needed to lead the next government. Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, who has just returned from a 2-day visit to London to consult with his counterpart Gordon Brown, has announced that he will visit Turkey on Monday for talks. According to sources, although claimed as a farewell visit, the Syrian track is bound to be discussed. Olmert told a conference for national security studies in Tel Aviv, quote, "Syria does not necessarily want to be part of the axis of evil. A peace treaty would lower the possibility of war, break the strategic ties between Damascus and Tehran, lead to the expulsion of Islamic Jihad and Hamas headquarters from Syria, and stop the cash flow to Hezbollah." He said he is prepared to take risks. Opposition leader Netanyahu is reported to have told French President Sarkozy that he supports diplomatic talks with Syria and intends to continue contacts. However, Israel's security needs require an Israeli presence in the Golan. You're listening to the news from Israel National Radio. According to a survey presented by Bar-Ilan University, few Jewish diaspora youth cite the Holocaust as having shaped their Jewish identity, but felt that it influenced their worldview. The survey, which spanned the decade between 1992 to 2002, was conducted among 60,000 youth aged 15 to 17 who were part of an Israel experience trip. They came from 20 different countries, including the US, Canada, the former Soviet Union, South America, Hungary, and South Africa. 37.6% said that the Holocaust was very influential in forming their worldview, while 54.5% said that it was influential, and 7% answered it was not. By contrast, only 20% said that symbols of the Holocaust helped to form their Jewish identity, but that family 96%, birth 90%, religion 72%, and culture 67% were the influence in forming their Jewish identity. Dr. Eric Cohen of Bar-Ilan's School of Education, who conducted the survey, said, quote, "It shows that young diaspora Jews' identities are being formed less by negative factors like antisemitism and hatred and more by positive ones such as education, upbringing, and religion." The weekend weather: Jerusalem 19 to 13 Celsius, Tel Aviv 22 to 17, Tiberias 24 to 14, Mount Hermon 5 to 12, Eilat 27 to 18 Celsius. Sunny everywhere with light winds, but the much-needed rain not yet on the horizon, except for Mount Hermon on Sunday. And finally, Heath and Deborah Campbell from Hunterdon County, New Jersey, were upset by the nearby ShopRite store, which refused to inscribe a birthday cake for their 3-year-old son with his full name, Adolf Hitler Campbell. ShopRite has also denied Campbell's request in previous years when he asked for a swastika on the cake. That was the news from Israel National Radio, compiled and read by Walter Bingham.
And now for your local weather, here's meteorologist Glenn Foxen.
Pittsburgh, PA will experience some wintry weather this Hanukkah. The winds will blow from the northwest and will bring cold and moist air from Canada and the Great Lakes. This weather pattern will result in below normal temperatures and the chance of scattered snow showers. The Jewish Experience radio program official Hanukkah weather forecast for Pittsburgh. On Monday, mostly cloudy and cold with snow showers, high in the 20s. We only expect a dusting to an inch. On Tuesday, partly cloudy and cold with scattered snow showers, high 25 to 30. On Wednesday, partly cloudy and cold with scattered snow showers, high near 30. On Thursday, partly cloudy and not as cold, high 30 to 35. Friday and Shabbos looks to have dry weather and pleasant conditions. This has been meteorologist Glenn Foxen wishing everyone good weather and great times this Shabbos and Hanukkah.
And it's Mazel Tov time, and here with the Mazel Tovs is Lovable Moish.
Yeah, nice to be back here on the show. Okay, a Mazel Tov to Mr. and Mrs. Jake Peled on the marriage of their daughter, Anit, and I know the music was great at that wedding because I played at that. Dr. and Dr. Menashe Weiss on the bar mitzvah of their daughter. Mr. and Mrs. Yisrael Brucker on the birth of a daughter. Rabbi Nosson and Sarah Sachs on the wedding of their daughter, Rachel. To Shalom Fox, Mr. and Mrs. Shalom Cohen on the wedding of their daughter Sarah Leah to Ellie Steifel. And a Mazel Tov to Dr. and Mrs. Emmanuel Canal and Mr. and Mrs. Dovi Nadov on the engagement of their children, Daniela Canal and Moshe Nadov. And finally, a Mazel Tov to Mr. and Mrs. Cohenbash on the engagement of Shalom to Leah Kossoff.
Now let's take a look at some events around the community. The holiday of Hanukkah starts this Sunday at sundown, December 21st. At 4:30 p.m., there'll be a Gala Hanukkah parade. Over 100 cars with rooftop menorahs will parade from yeshiva schools with a police escort all over Shadyside and Squirrel Hill and will eventually end up at the waterfront in Homestead, where a menorah lighting will take place. County Executive Dan Honorato will give holiday greetings to the assembled. On Monday, December 22nd, there'll be a grand menorah lighting with Mayor Luke Ravenstahl at the City County Building on Grant Street. Also at 4:30 p.m., everyone is invited. Wednesday night, December 24th, is Fun Fest night at Harmerville Lanes. The entire community is invited to the cornucopia of fun. Call 412-781-1800 for more information. Esther Schorp, Dean of Blitzstein Institute of Hebrew Theological College, will speak at a brunch Sunday, December 21st, Clothing of Light, Symbolism of Garments in the Bible at the Kollel Jewish Learning Center in Squirrel Hill. Congregation B'nai Amuna will have a Hanukkah dinner and menorah lighting on Sunday, December 21st at 4:50 p.m. Please call the synagogue to reserve your spot. Congregation Beth Sholem will have a family Hanukkah brunch on Sunday morning, December 28th, from 10 a.m. to noon. There'll be games, activities, music, and food. Don't forget, candlelighting time this week, 4:38 p.m. And we're a special treat today. We have Rabbi Chaim Richman, who is the director of the International Department of the Temple Institute in Jerusalem. He's been an Israeli resident for 26 years, been with the Institute for 20 years. Rabbi Richman, welcome to the program.
Shalom, shalom.
Shalom, shalom. So let's talk a little bit. It's the holiday of Hanukkah coming up, and Hanukkah is the whole concept of Chanukat HaBayit, the rededication of the temple. And this, of course, is the time of the year probably where you're most busy in terms of focus and interest in the Har HaBayit and the Beis HaMikdash. So let's get right to it. You're with the Temple Institute. Tell us a little bit about what the Temple Institute is and why it is necessary.
Well, the Temple Institute, Machon HaMikdash in Hebrew, is a non-profit educational organization which is dedicated towards the realization as much as humanly possible in the reality of today, according to Halakha, the realization of Hashem's command to the Jewish people, Asu l'Mikdash v'shichanta b'tocham, you shall build for me a sanctuary. This actually is one of the positive commandments. There's a lot of different opinions that people have, when is the temple going to be rebuilt? Does Mashiach have to come first? Some people believe it's going to fall down from heaven. Our position, based on Halakha, based on the Rambam, based on our understanding of our state of the blessed memory, is that the Jewish people are obligated to rebuild the temple. Now, obviously, that's a mouthful. There's a geopolitical reality in the modern state of Israel, etc. But basically, all of those issues we address. This is not a concept of taking over the Temple Mount or something like that. First and foremost, it's an idea of educating our people and really the whole world to realize the central theme, the central role that the Beit HaMikdash really fills in the spiritual life of Israel and mankind. And so our goal is really to do as much as possible through education, through research, and as you'll hear, actually through a certain type of action as well, to really try and get our consciousness refocused on the fact that basically without the Holy Temple, we're like fish without water.
Sure. So give us an idea of some concrete programs that are going on right now at the Temple Institute to carry out some of these programs.
Well, in addition to research and actually a kollel that publishes very beautiful Chidushei Torah, novel Torah publications about every concept of the Beit HaMikdash, and seminars and conferences, one of the major focal points of our work is actually an exhibition on display in the Old City of Jerusalem of clay charet, of sacred vessels that are being made today for the resumption of the service in the Holy Temple. So what I mean to say is that our Holy Torah describes that there are actually 93 categories of vessels that are used in the Beit HaMikdash. And here I'm referring to the gold and silver and copper vessels that we read about in those sections of the Book of Exodus and that our Chazal tell us about, and also, of course, the priestly garments that are worn by the descendants of Aaron. All of these things we are actually creating today. These are not things that were found in an archaeological dig. We're building them today according to the exact specifications and the requirements of Jewish law. So not only is it the first time that they can be seen on the face of the earth since the destruction of the temple, but they're actually kosher, fitting to use in the Beit HaMikdash. So this is like, in a way, and I can explain to you how, kind of like the first stage of the rebuilding of the temple itself. And let me just say at this point that listeners can go to www.templeinstitute, that's one word, .org, and that is the most informative sites in the World Wide Web in the English language about everything regarding the Holy Temple and the Temple Mount. You have literally hundreds and hundreds of pages of material.
That's great. And the concept, of course, of creating these vessels from scratch, I guess, is an incredible holy work. Of course, on the other side, there are some people that say you can't begin this, or you can't begin the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash or the Beit HaMikdash until the coming of Mashiach. And you say, halachically, you can. How do you resolve this?
Well, it's really interesting when you start to look at the sources and realize how much misunderstanding and preconceived notions there are kind of in the mentality of our people. A lot of it comes from the whole experience of 2,000 years of exile, but, it's interesting that when you begin learning in Hilchot Beit HaBechira, in the laws of the chosen house, in seminal work of Maimonides, our master the Rambam, and his Mishneh Torah, when he starts talking about the Beit HaMikdash, the very first thing he says is, it's a positive commandment to rebuild the Holy Temple, ready to be bringing the Korbanot there for all of Israel to make a pilgrimage there three times a year. And the truth is, when we begin to analyze the structure of Jewish law, we begin to see that none of the mitzvot in the Torah are the purview of one person to accomplish. Mm-hmm. In other words, Rambam himself writes in another sefer in Gerat Hashmah, he writes that Mashiach doesn't come to tell us, oh, now it's time to do a particular mitzvah, or I'm going to do this mitzvah for you, but rather all of the commandments were commanded to all of the Jewish people for all time. And so too, when it came to the returning exiles at the time of the Second Temple, there was no Mashiach at that point. In fact, the verse in the Torah borrows a phrase, and Hashem himself, God calls Cyrus, the Gentile king of Persia, my anointed one, my Mashiach, because he stirred him up and told the Jewish people to go home and build the temple. This is just kind of one window I'm trying to open.
That's a great
up
point. Yeah,
let
great
people
point.
Understand it's quite a complex issue. Another question that people ask very often is, well, how can you build these things today if we're all in a state of impurity? And that's a good question.
That is a good question.
And here again, the Rambam, who is basically the address when it comes to all matters pertaining to the laws of the Holy Temple, he tells us a very important principle in his Mishnah Torah. He tells us that there's a halacha that when the Jewish people are all found in a state of impurity, when it comes to matters of congregational importance, tumah hutrabet tzibur, the impurity is it's permissible when it comes to matters of congregational importance, you just go ahead with it in a state of impurity as well. And so the only thing that's really missing to make the final stage, to make these vessels be able to be used, is, of course, you can probably guess, the ashes of the paraduma, the red heifer, as described in the Sefer Bamidbar, the 19th chapter of the Book of Numbers.
And we have heard that there may have been some sightings or may have been some actual species that have been identified. Do you have any information on that?
Well, you know, as part of the witness protection plan, I can't tell you too much about that. But let me just say that if that's what's keeping people up at night, the fact that we don't have any red heifers, let me tell you, you can sleep easy. We've got it covered.
Very good. That's a chiddush right here. Okay, and so the now you had mentioned before we went on the air here that. That you do not have as part of the Temple Institute the Atarat Kohanim, the training of the Kohanim to do this. Are you related in any way to this yeshiva that's preparing these, and do you have any joint programs together?
Well, the Temple Institute, Machon HaMikdash, has a kolo, which is a academy of higher Torah studies, wherein we have many Kohanim that are studying the laws of the Korbanot, the offerings in the Temple, and, in fact, publishing many Chidushi Torah. We have a very beautiful edition of the Talmud Tractate Yoma, which is, of course, the section of the Talmud that deals with the complicated service of the high priest in the Holy Temple on Yom Kippur. At this point in time, in fact, in time for Hanukkah, we're also publishing a very unique sefer, a book about the menorah of the Holy Temple, which is, of course, a very complex concept, how the menorah was created, and indeed, when we come to the story of Hanukkah, how did the Hashmonaim create the menorah if it had been rendered impure and, in fact, destroyed? It's a very interesting question in history. We're also publishing now a new encyclopedia on the level of the Talmudic Encyclopedia, an encyclopedia of Holy Temple concepts. This is first coming out in Hebrew. Soon it will be in English as well. One of the most interesting projects that we are doing now as part of this kolel is we are actually weaving bigdei kohuna, priestly garments, for men of the descent of Aharon for service in the Holy Temple. And basically these are made to order, and people are actually ordering them and keeping them for the day when they will be needed. And of course the reason for this is because there is a clarification in Jewish law that every single set of garments for the Kohanim has to be made specifically to order.
Yes.
It's not like buying something off the rack or one size fits all, but the verse which says, L'chavod u'l'tifaret, which means that Hashem told Moshe to make these garments for honor and for glory, our sages of blessed memory tell us that these words mean that one aspect is that they have to fit absolutely perfectly each man. So each Kohen actually has to be measured to receive priestly garments. It's quite a program. And to date, over 30 Kohanim have purchased priestly garments, which they're keeping for the time of the Holy Temple.
That's incredible. And we are out of time. And I just want to tell you, it's such an exciting work that you're doing. And with the advent, the imminent coming of Mashiach, it should happen immediately, even before the end of this program. We want to thank you very much for doing what you do. And hopefully our listeners should visit templeinstitute.org to get more information and help to participate. Rabbi Chaim Richman, the director of the International Department of the Temple Institute, thank you for being a part of the Jewish Experience. Have a good Shabbos. And a Freilich and Hanukkah.
And blessings and happy Hanukkah to everyone.
People and nations are striving to create a world of goodness and kindness. A blueprint exists for a better world. Thousands of years ago, the human race was given a plan for a quality life. There are 7 universal laws to follow, known as the laws of Noah. These universal truths include: believe in God, honor God, do not murder, do not commit adultery or incest, do not steal, avoid cruelty to animals, establish courts of justice.
it's time to take a look at the feminine side of things with the feminine perspective. Here's Miss Devorah DeLynn.
It's every woman's worst fear come the winter season. As soon as the floors are freshly washed, waxed, and polished, the children come home and track in our favorite winter companion, thick black mud. After a quick scold and the immediate removal of all footwear, the children are sent off and the mother must quickly get rid of the mud before it sets in and leaves a mark. Funny that something so simple would be such a pain. Anyway, Hanukkah! Yes, the time has arrived for family gatherings, friendly games, and delicious hot foods, some of them fried in olive oil. Everybody knows the story of how the Greeks fought the Jews won the war, they found a jug of oil that was supposed to last for one day, and lasted miraculously for eight. Well, if you look at the Hebrew word for Greece, Yavan, it's spelled with a yud that gets a little longer and becomes a vav, that gets a little longer and becomes a final nun. It truly looks like a progression of the same letter, just getting longer and longer. The Greeks were renowned for their philosophy, for their ability to look at a problem rationally and find an intellectual solution. Naturally, they assumed that the rational choice between life and death would be assuredly life. Therefore, when they forced their decrees upon the Jews and forbade irrational religion on penalty of death, they assumed they would have no problem. However, they didn't realize that Judaism itself is irrational. We are not Jews because our brain makes us so. We are because we simply are. This is our faith. Greek philosophy, according to Chassidus, is likened to mud. Just as mud is a mixture of dirt that slowly seeps into water until the water becomes a thick, gooey paste, the culture of the Greeks at the time infiltrated slowly, trickle by trickle, until the Torah, our Mayim Chayim, our water of life, was tainted in the minds of many Jews. The yud in the name Yavan represents knowledge, as the Tanya states. In this case, it represents the impure knowledge of the Greeks that slowly gained entree into the minds of the Jews. It then lengthened until it became a vav. The numerical value of the letter vav is 6, representing the 6 mitos, or character traits. A person doesn't realize that what he used to be passively learning has now become an active part of his character. The disease spreads until it lengthens to become a final nun, about which it is stated, Limata min hashura, that it's under the line. A person becomes so full of these impure ideas that his character sinks to the lowest of depths. This is another explanation to the words, Shetam'u kol hashmanim shebehechal, that the Greeks made impure the oil of the temple. Not merely did they break the seal of the Kohanim on the jugs of oil, but the Torah, which is sometimes compared to oil, was made impure through the penetration of the ideas of the Greeks. Jews are meant to live, to enjoy, and to be involved in the ways of the world. Hashem placed us here for a reason. However, it is easy to become ensnared by the glittering facade that is the world. It's easy to believe that we have no obligations, that humanity is nothing, and that the only thing we can blame ourselves for is global warming. But the Torah's greatest gift was the gift of responsibility. The knowledge that we are what we are and that we have a job to do. The world is ours to care for, and the world is ours to fill with light. Have a happy Hanukkah.
Okay, let's get some music going over here with Miami Boys Choir, Hanukkah Special. Light up the night. This one is entitled Al Hanisim. I'm Moshe Pekar. You're tuned in and good to go on the J.E.
Yeah.
Now it's time for another classic story from our master storyteller, Rabbi Meir Goldwasser.
The well-known chassid, Rav Berki Chain, was once taken to the interrogation cellars, where he was interrogated and severely tortured in Russia. The government wanted to know who had organized the mass smuggling of Hasidim via the Polish border, but Rav Berki didn't say a word. After extended interrogations and torture, Rav Berki was given the death sentence. A miracle occurred, and his sentence was mitigated to 18 years of hard labor in Siberia. His sentence was reduced yet again to 10 years of prison. When Rav Berki would tell of his suffering in Soviet jail, he would draw his listeners into the story. Great pain was apparent in his voice. "I was persecuted endlessly for the terrible crime of teaching Torah to children and spreading Judaism and Hasidus. I was always able to avoid them, but when I tried to leave the country, I was caught. After the arrest, they began the terrible interrogations and torture. The sentence was death, but thanks to Hashem's kindness, I was sentenced to many years in Siberia. Now is not the time to describe everything that happened to me, all the suffering that was my daily lot, all the plots they devised day and night. I sat in jail with criminals, murderers, thieves, and other crooks. They had a leader who had sole power over them. His appearance was enough to instill fear. And this was the group I was sentenced to sit with. But thanks to Hashem, I have found favor in their eyes for some reason, and they respected me and did not harm me. Erev Chanukah, thoughts filled my mind of Jews lighting candles, singing Chanukah songs, and eating latkes and rejoicing, while I was in great darkness. I had no candles, no latkes, no Chanukah songs, and no joyous Hasidische Farbrengen. I would have to celebrate Chanukah with these criminals. I sat there sadly, and one of the prisoners noticed and asked, 'Rabin, why are you sad? How can I help you?' I gave him some excuse, but he wasn't the type to be dismissed so readily. A minute later, he came back with the leader. 'What's up with you? Here in prison, there are no secrets. We are all friends.' Woe to have such friends, I thought, but I had no choice but to tell him that a holiday would begin that night called Chanukah, when we light candles, but I had no holiday and no candles, and that is why I was sad. 'We will see what we can do for you,' he said. 'What do you need in order to celebrate the holiday?' I told him that I needed to light candles, but even if I had the candles, it was forbidden to light them in jail. 'Let me take care of the rules in jail. Don't worry. We'll arrange candles for you.' He went off, and I looked at him in amazement, wondering whether he was serious or was making a joke at my expense. A few minutes later, he returned and said, 'It's all arranged, honored Rabbi. I spoke with some friends, and each one agreed to set aside some of the margarine that we were allotted. We will put the margarine in half of an onion, and you will have candles.' I was stunned. 'And what about fire?' I stammered. 'In the evening, you will see,' he declared arrogantly. I still couldn't digest the fact that I would be lighting Chanukah candles that evening. It was evening, and the leader brought me the margarine that the other prisoners had collected, and wicks from their coats. I put the margarine in the hollow of the onion, placed the wicks, and waited for fire. When everything was ready, the leader told his friends to surround me like a wall in order to hide the light. He himself took a piece of material, put it on the wooden floor, and began to rub it with his boot. I couldn't see exactly how he did it, but suddenly the material was smoking, and a minute later, there was fire. With great emotion, I recited the brachas of Lahadlik Ner Chanukah and Sha'aso Nisim, and as I said the Shachyonu, I cried. I lit the wick, and an enormous wave of joy flooded my heart that cannot be described. As long as the candles burned, the prisoners stood around and hid me with their bodies and coats. This is what they did every night of Chanukah. Fortunately, the jailers didn't notice anything, and so I celebrated Chanukah in the Soviet jail with the help of these people. This is Rabbi Meir Goldwasser wishing you all a good Shabbos and a very joyous Chanukah.
And so we come to the close of yet another exciting Chanukah edition of the Jewish Experience radio program. We want to thank Rabbi Chaim Richman and Yisrael Meidad for giving us the information on the temple and its importance and the political update in Israel. And of course, we always want to thank our faithful and cutting-edge staff, Rabbi Meir Goldwasser, Rabbi Moshe Bakar, whose fingers deftly covering over the keys as he takes us out this afternoon, and reminds everyone for your next Simcha to keep him in mind. And Dr. Michael Shulman, Ms. Devorah DeLynn, and our engineer, Jeremiah LeBossenstein, back with us for another outstanding show. Don't forget, candlelighting time this evening is 4:38 p.m. It's been a lot of fun, but we do have to run. We all hope to be back when the resources permit. Don't forget to write your ideas to jewishexperience@verizon.net. We read all emails, we really do. I'm Hirsch DeLynn, along with Moshe Bakar. Have a wonderful Shabbos and a Freilich and Chanukah. We'll see you all on the web at jewishexperienceradio.com anytime, and hopefully, Mirtz Hashem, back here soon. It's truly up to yins, or y'all, or you guys, whatever you say. Stay well, and let's hear only good news.